Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. A personal tribute to the memory of Cardinal John Patrick Foley. Lighting up the Christmas tree in St. Peter's Square. When Pope Benedict visits a Roman prison this Sunday, he'll be treading in the footsteps of Blessed John the 23rd. And popular hymns for the last Sunday before Christmas. I'd like to begin today with a tribute to the memory of the late Cardinal John Patrick Foley, whose funeral took place on Friday afternoon in Philadelphia. I'd like to share with you memories of his early years in Rome. He arrived here the year following his ordination to the priesthood to study philosophy at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas. But it was at an exciting time in the history of the Catholic Church. Listen, as he himself tells us why.
He's 1 year ordained, and I was assigned here to do graduate work in philosophy at the Angelicum, the University of St. Thomas Aquinas. Graduate work in philosophy to get my doctorate. And at the same time, I was to work on reporting on the Second Vatican Council for the diocesan newspaper in Philadelphia and for Catholic News Service. So I had the opportunity to be present at a number of events of the Second Vatican Council. Every day I was present for the news briefings and for what was called the U.S. Bishops' Press Panel, which was in the basement of the old USO headquarters on the Via della Conciliazione, right around the corner from the current location of the studios of Vatican Radio. And it was fascinating because you had all of the major theologians or the major figures of the council who would come there to speak to the journalists at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And of course the Italians thought that that was a barbaric hour to have anything, but the Americans thought that that was quite logical to have something at 3 in the afternoon. And for 1 hour each day, there was this background briefing on the issues that were discussed, the clarification of factual points, and conjecture about what would be happening. It was a fascinating time to be a journalist in Rome, to be a priest in Rome, to be a Catholic in Rome.
Can you describe some of the ceremonies to me? Or some of the ceremonies you attended, or even, you know, the actual flow of priests and monsignors and cardinals coming out of St. Peter's?
Well, every day at 12:30, it looked as if St. Peter's was having a hemorrhage, because all of this purple and red just flowed down the steps, because the cardinals and the bishops every day would wear choir dress, which was the scarlet or purple cassock with a type of surplice, a cotta, and a purple cape, a little cape, or a scarlet cape over that. Every day they would be dressed like this, coming down the steps. And then for solemn occasions, for the opening or closing of a session or for the promulgation of conciliar decrees, all of the cardinals and bishops would be dressed in copes and mitres, and the Eastern Rite bishops in crowns. So you can imagine what that looked like as they came out of St. Peter's dressed like that, or were in a procession like that, about 2,000 bishops. And of course, in those days, the Pope was carried on his sedia gestatoria, the chair, which allowed him to be viewed by the people in the crowd. In one way, perhaps it was better that the Pope was carried into St. Peter's, because you didn't have the scene as you do today of people scrambling up on chairs and almost toppling over one another in order to see the Pope. He was high and everybody could see him clearly. And the silver trumpets from the back window of St. Peter's, way up high, would play the papal hymn as the Pope was carried up the middle aisle. And I must say, with the stands that were erected for the Second Vatican Council, with individual seats, assigned seats for each cardinal and bishop and patriarch, it was a magnificent sight, which I will never forget. And I would think that its like may never be seen again, because the number of bishops has grown so greatly, and the expense of such events would have grown greatly. So it was a privilege to be present for both the manifestation of the universality of the Church, the unity of the Church, and also for the exciting nature of the discussions that were carried on.
The arrival of the Pope on the St. Jago Stradiuma must have created a kind of a stir in the crowd.
Well, I, as an American, had not been accustomed to people clapping and cheering in church. You know, I presume that the same type of decorum is present in the British Isles as well, where we were expected always to be quiet in church, which I must say I prefer. But I remember my first time there for a papal ceremony, when people began to cheer and clap as the Pope was carried up the aisle. And as I said, it was very easy to see the Holy Father in that situation. You didn't have to strain or crane to see him. There he was right before your eyes. And it was a thrilling experience to see the Vicar of Christ coming into the church which contained the tomb of his first predecessor. I was deeply moved. In those days, of course, also, the Pope wore a crown, a tiara, the triple crown. And it was a magnificent sight, and very stirring, very moving. There are certainly very many moving ceremonies in the church now, but, of course, I was a young priest, only 27 years old, here in Rome for the first time I had ever been in Europe, and to see the opening of the second session of the council, that's what I was here for, was for me one of the unforgettable experiences of my life. The end of that second session, by the way, was the occasion on which they had the promulgation of the first two documents of the Second Vatican Council, Sacrosanctum Concilium on the liturgy and Intermorifica on communications. So little did I know that 20 years after I was present in St. Peter's for the promulgation of the decree which called for the establishment of a special office for communications, that I would be the president of that office back here at the Vatican.
You were listening there to the voice of Cardinal John Patrick Foley, who passed away on Sunday, 11th of December, in the United States. We will miss him here at Vatican Radio. And now, moving on in the broadcast on a lighter note, I'd like to tell you about a fir tree which once stood deep in a remote Ukrainian forest. One loaded onto a large lorry and taken 2,000 kilometres south to Rome, to St. Peter's Square. There a crane lifted it into the position where it now stands proud, and where it was lighted on Friday afternoon. It's the story of this year's Vatican Christmas tree. In an effort to find out more about it, I went to the square to meet up with an architect from the technical department of the Vatican's governing body, the Governatorato. She's Barbara Bellano. But why don't you join us there? I'm speaking to Barbara Bellano, who is an architect. She works at the technical department of the governing body of the Holy See, the Governatorato.
Barbara, we're standing in St. Peter's Square and there's a huge Christmas tree here. It's a tradition that goes back to John Paul II in 1982.
John Paul II decided to put here in St. Peter's Square symbols of Christmas, the Christmas tree and, of course, the Christmas crib.
What's special about this year's Christmas tree?
This huge Christmas tree coming from Ukraine, from Zakarpattia is the region exactly. It's 30 meters high. The weight is around 5 tons. It arrives here at the beginning of December, and now we are decorating with our traditional Christmas balls. As you can see, they are gold and silver balls. They are LED lights, so we pay attention to energy problems, and we have some Ukraine decoration this year.
They're all in yellow, aren't they? The papal colours.
Yeah.
This tree comes from the Ukraine. In the past years, it's come from other countries in Europe.
Yeah, every year we have different European countries. This is the first time that it comes from a former Soviet country. The other one came from Poland, from Germany, from Austria and from Czech Republic. The most part came from Italy, and even the highest was from Italy, because it was from Calabria. It was followed by a German one who was almost 32 meters high. The Italian one was around 35, 34.
It's almost as tall as the obelisk, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are there other Christmas trees that come with this one, no?
We have 40 smaller Christmas crib. We are decorating them inside the Vatican. Every year we are involved in the project of the Christmas tree and of the Christmas tree, of course. In September we get in touch with maybe with the embassy or with the sindaco, with the halls of the Italian country to organize everything. So it's a long project that begins at the end of summer.
And how long does the tree stay up here?
Till the beginning of February, February the 2nd, when we remove everything.
And warm thanks there go to architect Barbara Bellano from the technical department of the Vatican's governing body known as the Governatorato. Moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to mention Pope Benedict XVI's scheduled visit to the inmates of a Roman prison this Sunday by recalling how on this occasion he'll be following in the footsteps of his predecessors to the See of Peter, among whom Blessed John XXIII on Christmas Day in 1958. But do stay tuned as I take you back in time by bringing you Pope John's words speaking to prisoners on this moving occasion, as well as the personal testimonies of some of those who witnessed this event, viewed by many as an act of restoration of some of the pastoral dimensions of the papacy. Among the guests are a Carmelite and a cardinal. Prisoners cheering, drowning out the voice of Pope John XXIII as he speaks to them behind the bars of a Roman prison. It was Christmas 1958, and in an unprecedented gesture, a pope was standing in their midst offering them words of comfort. "When you write home," he said, "be sure to tell your families the pope has been to see you."
La prima lettera che scrivete adesso a casa vostra deve portare la notizia che il Papa è venuto in mezzo a voi e che vi promette, anche lui dice il suo rosario e quindi fa passare bene i grani della sua corona, dice la sua messa, che si impegna...
You could come to see me, so I came to see you. I wasn't just going to the prison, but it was his manner in the prison. You know, the way he greeted the prisoners, and in his talk right away he said, "Listen, I know it's tough in my own family. One of my cousins ended up here too."
At the time, the late Father Redemptus Wallerbeck was a young Carmelite seminarian in Rome. He recalled the enormous impact of John XXIII's visit to the prison.
So right away there was that personal with the prisoners. You could see some of them in the pictures, you know, crying that that the Pope would come to see them, which had never happened before.
Nobody had ever gone to the prisons like that on Christmas Day. I mean, he thought of, you know, the little ones in hospital and the people in prison. He didn't respect the protocol. I mean, he went straight at it. If he wanted to talk to somebody, he would talk to them.
Didn't it irritate the Vatican?
Oh, well, career? I mean, I don't know. I wasn't on that side of the war.
But, you know, I mean, weren't there critical comments about this in the newspapers at the time? You know, what's Pope doing? Or
I don't remember critical comments at all, because
when the Pope visited the Bambin Gesù Children's Hospital, Jill Tyler was a young journalist in Rome, reporting for the most popular British Catholic newspaper.
There were no sort of comments about the political ways of doing things or anything like that. It was always, it was just that he went to the people.
Io sono venuto qui, come vedete, in perfetta condizione di salute, non proprio pronto a fare una corsa, entrare in una gara, ma insomma però per misurarli con la comune, ecco.
And suddenly you had this Pope who acted out of instinct, who said what was on his mind, who responded to people. I mean, they say the first time he went to a hospital, Bambino Gesù here in Rome, the children all started screaming, Pope, come here, Pope, come here, Papa, vieni, vieni, you know, come here. And he said, okay, the Pope is coming, I'm coming to see you. It was just, it was a natural instinct on his part. And it was so astounding. It was, he, you might say, to some degree, that he restored some of the pastoral dimensions of the papacy.
Historian Father Paul Robichaud of the Paulist Order grew up in the United States during John XXIII's pontificate. They must go back to your childhood, I think, John the 23rd.
Well, I was in grade school when Pope John the 23rd became Pope in 1958. I was just 10 years old. I remember a few recollections because television was something very new in my family. And so the idea that you could actually see something about the election of a pope on television, and that the warmth that this pope exuded, and what came with that warmth were all of these, this great excitement about the church, and that things were somehow changing in the church. And so during the years of his pontificate period, where I was going from the age of 10 to the age of 15, going through adolescence, rebellion, and so I'm sure to some degree that the changes that the church brought about by the calling of the Vatican Council probably were reflective of some of my feelings at the time and made the church more interesting and exciting. But I think more importantly was this incredible sense of his warmth and his presence and how it seemed to be impacting on my parish, my school, the parochial life that surrounded me, and how things seemed to be less rigid and personal and engaging. And so the very personality of the Pope seemed to come all the way down to my local parish somewhere and express itself in a lot of warmth and care.
Della luce va a portarla in santa pazienza, in pazienza, un esercizio. E poi, precisamente, lo spettacolo, spettacolo della carità.
When we saw the Pope, and we saw him really as friendly, as simple, may be a misleading word, because he was a very intelligent person and he was much deeper than people thought.
Nigerian-born Cardinal Francis Arinze was in Rome studying for the priesthood at the time. He felt Papa Roncalli played a key role in giving life to the missionary church.
He called Vatican II and prepared for it. It's no act of just a simple person. It's rather deep, but very friendly. He makes you feel at ease. And even when he visited our college in Propaganda, as we were then Urban, Collegio Urbano di Propaganda Fide, I remember a phrase he used. I think he said, our two hills look at one another and understand each other. That is the Vatican Hill and the Janiculum Hill, because Collegio Urbano is on the other hill, immediately overlooking the Vatican. So we liked him, and it was in his pontificate then we were ordained priests, and we were very happy to have such a pope. He loved the mission church, and he showed it by the way he treated the mission college, by the way he treated the mission bishops. Indeed, from that time, the number named bishops in the mission countries increased at a very fast rate.
The first thing he did is he suddenly empowered a whole new generation of church leaders. He created four consistories, a whole new college of cardinals. He invited the bishops of the world to come to Rome for an ecumenical council, And where originally the Curia controlled the original agenda for the council, and that turned around, he eventually empowered all of these bishops to move. So one of the things that's very interesting is, even though he appears non-collegial, or someone who's very decisive and single-minded in what he did, he was the great facilitator.
Pope John the 23rd was very far-seeing, and we also admired his openness to other Christians. I think once he gave a ring to an Anglican, that was, for us, it was most symbolic. It was almost revolutionary. That was a very eloquent act. It meant taking them seriously as our fellow Christians with whom we want to prepare for that day when we will be reunited, as Christ didn't want two churches or three or four or 500, but just one. The fact that when he died, everybody agreed this was a great pope and a saint. Even the communists would be in favor that he should be canonized, so which is very good. And the other Christians would be in favor too.
One of the things he said when he was dying was that there's not a person that I met in my life that I didn't love. He was a very positive person who could find the good in people, even good in people who you would traditionally consider your enemies or on the other side of the fence. So he fit in with the spirit of the times very well. I remember his Pacem in Terris, his very famous encyclical letter, which again made a big splash. I mean, the New York Times, which was not known to be very favorable to the papacy, carried article on article about this really groundbreaking document. But, I mean, that's just one instance of all over the world. Even I remember the communists in Moscow reacted to it, which was, flabbergasting. We couldn't believe it, that there would be some reaction. In fact, they came to call the peace priest movements in the satellite countries, Pacem in Terris, those priests who were collaborating with the communist regimes. They called them Pacem in Terris in commemorating the encyclical of Pope John the 23rd. It was a very broad encyclical, how we should foster peace on earth. And it was broad enough to include many things. And I think everyone could resonate with the basic premise that he had at the beginning, that if you want peace in the world, it has to begin with peace in your heart and the peace in the heart of every individual. And I think that resonates with many people, not just Catholics or Christians or even religiously oriented people. That's why I do think that he hit at certain basic truths that many people could agree with, even if they weren't particularly religious. I think that's what made him so popular.
A fare speciali intenzioni per ciascuno di loro, le vostre mogli, le vostre sorelle, le vostre...
Finally, I'd like to end the program on a more musical note to mark the last Sunday before Christmas. That's with music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
And all above there lay a salt tree, on which he made a night's melody, so sweetly that all the chamber rung, and Angelus ad Virginem he sung. Geoffrey Chaucer wrote those lines in his Canterbury Tales. They come from the Miller's Tale, and they tell of a young clerk called Nicholas, who was obviously a good musician. Angelus ad Virginem was a popular medieval carol with a strong, lilting rhythm that made it suitable for singing out of doors, on processions, and on pilgrimages. There's every chance that Chaucer's pilgrims would have sung it on their way to Canterbury. It tells the story of the angel Gabriel appearing to Mary and inviting her to become the Mother of God. As we approach the end of Advent, our thoughts turn more and more to Mary, who is soon to give birth to the long-awaited Saviour. Our Gospel readings on the fourth Sunday of Advent help us to focus on the child in Mary's womb. Mary replied to the angel, "Behold, the handmaid of the Lord. Let it be done to me according to your word." With those words, she accepted in joyful obedience the role that God had designed for her in his great plan for the salvation of the world. The mystery of the Annunciation has inspired painters and musicians for centuries. One of my favourite Advent carols tells the story using the music of an old folk melody from the Basque region. The words are by a rather eccentric Anglican priest called Sabine Baring Gould, who was rector of Lew Trenchard in Devon at the turn of the 20th century. He also wrote Onward Christian Soldiers, set to music by Sir Arthur Sullivan. That's a hymn you don't hear too often these days, but his other famous hymn, The Angel Gabriel, is still popular with English-speaking congregations the world over. It captures perfectly the mood of joyful expectation that marks these last days of Advent.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. So do join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.